Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the show, I'm speaking with blade collector, martial artist, and knife content creator, Steve Price. Steve has been impressing me for quite a while with his amazing collection of ethnographic knives, swords, and tomahawks made by smiths from around the globe. But not only does he show his impressive stash of exotic weaponry, Steve is an accomplished martial artist and illustrates the efficacy of the blades he collects in astounding cutting demonstration videos. Steve is also a first responder, a family man, and a regular contributing voice to Thursday Night Knives. We'll find out how he got into all of these amazing swords and also how he acquired those skills. But first, be sure to like, comment, subscribe, hit the notification bell, and download the show to your favorite podcast app. And as always, if you want to help support the show, you can do so on Patreon. Quickest way to get there is to go to theknifejunkie.com/Patreon. That's theknifejunkie.com/Patreon.
Get cash back on almost everything and support the Knife Junkie channel. Start saving today. TheKnifeJunkie.com/cashback.
If you search Google for the best knife podcast, the answer is The Knife Junkie Podcast.
Steve, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. What an honor.
Like I said, I've been watching you do these cut videos for quite some time, and they are really impressive, and the weapons you use are impressive and different, and stuff you just don't see much of. That's why I've always been kind of fascinated with your collection, and we're going to talk about it. You obviously have a lot of really cool stuff all around you. We'll take a look at, but I want to find out a little more about you and how you got to be skilled like that. But first of all, I mentioned you're a first responder, right?
Yes, sir. I just retired January 1st. As a captain with Engine 1B here in Huntsville, Alabama. I gave them 27 years and 3 months. And before that, from 1989 to 1995, I was also a Huntsville police officer. So I gave the city 33 years total.
Wow. That's awesome. I'm sure they thank you for your service. I work adjacent to a lot of first responders, and I'm always impressed by them and I don't know, the character to go into danger and to help out. How do you think that like working as a firefighter, working as a police officer, how did that stoke your love of blades or was that around long before?
Yeah, that was around long before. You're talking about the martial arts. Well, my history in martial arts goes way back to the mid-70s, because I'm 57 years old. So back around 1977, 1978, a man named Yong Lee moved to Huntsville from Seoul, South Korea. He opened up Kong Sudo Studio. And my father was in real estate at the time, and he sold him his house when he moved here. So me and my younger brother started our journey to Kong Sudo. And that's how I first got started in martial arts. Of course, all through those years, I was watching the normal movies everybody was watching back then, which was Bruce Lee of the 70s, and that really stoked my interest. Billy Jack was probably my hero of all time, and that was just due to, he studied Hapkido, and it was taught that for the movie. But his love for the American Indian and fighting for the underdog, if you've watched his movies.
Yeah.
That really just sit well with me. And so that started my journey to martial arts. Years later, when I became a police officer, there was a man here that was teaching Wing Chun Kung Fu. And that's a funny story, Bob. So you have to, this was like a movie setting. So we had a motorcycle club that was in this block building on a certain street here in Huntsville. And in the back of this motorcycle club was the Wing Chun studio. So you had to be pretty brave just to get to the Wing Chun. But my love for Wing Chun started there. And then later on, as a police officer, I studied Jōshikai karate, which is a brother to Kyoshikin. Masayama was the founder of both of those systems from Japan. And that's where my love of martial arts started. But a funny story here, I never studied weapons during all of those different martial arts. I just picked up the blades just out of curiosity and from watching Forged in Fire. And it was just a natural innate ability to maneuver the blades the way I do. People always ask me, like, where did you study your blade systems or who taught you this? And I'm like, nobody taught it to me. I was just self-taught.
Huh. So I totally assumed that since you posted on your Instagram feed various Iaido demonstrations from Japanese masters, I sort of figured that that's where you picked it up or that's where you learned it, because you're doing cut tests, unlike so many, not cut tests, but cut demos on bottles and paper and all sorts of stuff. But you're doing it from the draw, from the sheath. You're not holding the knife in your hand and then cutting. And I find that very impressive because you're always kind of dropping the target and then drawing the knife. It's not on a post or anything like that.
And it's funny you say that because there are Japanese, highly respected Japanese martial artists. One of them was raised in the way of the samurai. His family go way back. He moved to Poland and started a martial arts school in the way of the samurai. And there's other samurai influencers in Japan. And when I started doing that, Bob, they all followed me and started liking what I did, which was an honor for me because I highly respect those men. And I don't count myself nowhere near the ability of those individuals. But it was just an honor for them to start following me.
So I'm curious. You did so many years of, I can't remember what kind of karate, but it was a Masayama. I know who he is, right? That's his name, Mas?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I just had a brain lock there. I had a whole magazine on him years ago, and he was pretty cool. With something I always liked were he used a lot of elbows, and I always liked elbows. But what I always wondered about karate is if it's developed for fighting someone with a sword when you're empty-handed, at least that's what I've heard. Does that make it less functional these days?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't really offend any of the traditionalists because that's how I grew up, is in the traditional styles. But I have to be honest about what we're talking about, too. And transparent in that. My eyes got opened. I remember I invited some friends over in 1992, I believe it was. I may be getting the year wrong. But when the first UFC was broadcast on pay-per-view, I invited some friends over, some martial artists and some other friends, and I did the pay-per-view for the very first, and my eyes got opened with Royce Gracie and that style of jiu-jitsu, which I'd never seen here before. You had a few people, very few people in Huntsville that were doing judo. No jiu-jitsu at that time. And that was against all different styles, no weight classes. The only thing you could not do in the UFC first tournament, you could not eye gouge, you could not bite. Everything else, groin strike, everything else was leak. And it showed you real quick what actually worked on the street in the real life. Because a lot of traditional karate with your reverse punches and your upper and downward blocks, and I understand about getting the technique down or the form down, but you have to spar, and a Kyoshikin is good about that. I will say that. Kyoshikin, those fighters are some of the toughest fighters around. I think they're flawed in one way, and that is they do not punch the head. Now, they can kick to the head in their tournaments and knock you out, and they can do that efficiently. But if you always practice not striking with your fist to the head, and in real life, you've lost some of that. For me, I would tell my children and anybody else that's interested, wrestling, Greco-Roman wrestling, Muay Thai, and Jiu-Jitsu. If you have those four bases grounded in you, then I don't think there's anything that can hinder you in that aspect. You're ready for about anything.
You said four, but you mentioned three. What was the fourth?
So I mentioned wrestling and Greco-Roman, which are two.
Oh, I got you.
Yes. And I'll throw in boxing in that too, Bob. Boxing is good, but if you notice throughout the years of boxers that get into street fights, most of them are smart enough not to do that. But they're used to hitting with gloves. And the first thing they get, if somebody ducks their head, they break their hand, set their career back. Because the bones of your head are very fragile. And if you watch Hoist and a lot of the Jiu-Jitsu guys back in the early days, they would use palm strikes to the back of the head, anywhere they could get. They would use that because they knew if they hit with the smallest bones in their body, you have a good chance of breaking.
Well, you obviously have quite a collection of swords, and we see them around you. How did it come to pass that you were collecting swords? Most of the people that we know who collect blades are into pocket knives and fixed blades and things that are, let's say, less expensive and more manageable, and you've got this like wicked collection of swords and things, and they're from all around the world. How did you start on this trip?
Well, I was fortunate in that aspect. Internet and YouTube, especially YouTube, Bob, there were a lot of blade forums, and I would get to see different makers and people around the world. When I first started out, being transparent, when I first started out, I was buying most of my blades, which is, is expensive, obviously. But when I started doing the videos, makers from around the world saw the videos, and they saw how many people were watching and the followers that I was accumulating, and they decided to start sending me the blades. So I didn't have to pay for the blade. And what it did, it guarded themselves. So the blade was my payment. And, of course, I didn't ask for any money or anything from the sales. Yeah, I was just honored that they thought highly enough of me to do that for me. And it was a privilege and an honor to me because I've been sent some very high-end blades, some very blood-off blades that are just exceptional. And I'll say this, too, is I'm very impressed. And don't get me wrong, I love our American makers, but I'm very impressed with some third-world makers. Who have minimal, very little tools, but they forge in the tradition of their ancestors, and they do an exceptional job.
All right, so a couple of weeks ago when we were first talking to one another, you wanted to hold off to talk to me until you got a certain new something. What is that? I'm dying to see what you got.
Okay. So I'll try to show this up close, the sheath. But if you can see that sheath, it is remarkable. So this blade is called the Yakubo. And what that stands for is what a Yakuza in Japan, it's like we have the Mafia over here. Japan has the Yakuza. That's their gangs. What they would carry if they were carrying a Bowie knife.
Oh.
So I will show you, I'm going to get over here and show you. Get close, show you the blade, and then show you this handle on a stand up.
Ooh, wow. What is that, a burl handle?
That looks like burl.
Wow.
It is, and it's full tang. It is an exceptional blade. And when I say extremely sharp, I'll do a video with it. It is extremely sharp. This came from Muhammad Hassan Said out of Indonesia. He owns Deli Craft, and he makes some superior blades. I've already done it. And here's the thing, too. His Delicraft emblem is here. He put my initials on the blade.
Oh.
And like I said, I told you I'd already done the free fall paper cut test, and it was nothing for this blade. So that's where I take a piece of paper, like a computer sheet of paper, I drop it and cut it midair, and it went through it like nothing. It was in front. The tip of this blade is amazing. And just, you can see how they force this blade. And it is just, I can't tell you how remarkable it is. It's very light, extremely light again. I should have weighed it, but I can tell you from the blades I own, it's one of the lightest blades I own. 12-inch blade, 6-inch handle. It is just unreal.
So this is made in Indonesia. What do you have any idea what the conditions are? I've seen a lot of Filipino cutlers, and to our Western eye, it looks somewhat primitive, or at least definitely somewhat impoverished, I guess.
Yes.
That's not exactly the right term, but...
That's correct. Very minimalistic, very basic. It's very minimal tools. And then, Bob, that's what's most impressive to me is I've seen this from one of my good friends, Perla Dhanal from Nepal. I've seen this from Muhammad and some others. Those are men of integrity. If they tell you they're going to make you a blade and send it to you in this amount of time, that's what they do. And they're in there on their knees, squatted down, fought over the coals, forging a blade with a guy, one or two guys hammering it out while they're moving it in and out, tempering the blade, forging it. And I have a lot of respect for those men because here in America, I have run into it. There's a lot of people running into this of having a blade made, and it takes 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years to get a blade. And so you have to wonder sometimes about people's work ethic, their integrity when it comes to that. But the men I mentioned are men of integrity.
Do you think some of that might have to do with the fact that, I don't know, I guess a lot of the cutlers I've seen are maybe a little bit older, and they're doing something in the traditional way, and it's kind of in there, it's like reflexive?
Yes. It is. They've been doing it for so long. Their ancestors have done it. So, and that's the thing. Over here in America, we have amazing blade smiths. We have amazing blade smiths that make amazing blades. But those cultures, for instance, in Nepal, Indonesia, over in China, and I'm talking about the traditional makers over there, traditional makers in Japan, Filipino makers. The Philippines, Indonesia, Nepal, those are blade cultures. So if you go back hundreds and hundreds of years, they've been making blades forever. And so in blade cultures, yes, they can forge out a blade fairly quick.
Yeah, like in the Philippines, it's an archipelago, many, many, many islands, and each island has towns, and each town has their blade designs and their different smiths who do different versions of old designs. And I just love that. I love that. What that traditional panoply that you see sometimes of all the different Filipino blades on the shield. I don't know. Yeah. I used to have a t-shirt of that. I love looking at that because they're so varied. And that's what I love about, your collection, for instance, is I have a little bit of ethnographic weaponry around me that my parents have gotten on their travels, or that I've gotten when I lived in New York and had access to flea markets and stuff like that, where I found some real gems, especially bringbacks. But all the variety of shape and kind of use that you get from weapons and knives from around the world. What is your wheelhouse, if you will? What are the kind of knives and swords that you really go after?
So anybody that knows me, and there's a story behind this. So the Kukri, and I have weapons from all over the world, and I love them all. But for me, it's, I can explain it. There's a Nepalese man, which, you know, being a Christian, we have different beliefs. But some of the Nepalese men have followed me over there for a while and seen me do the things with the Kukri, especially the reverse fast draw with the Kukri. This one is from Pandar Dal of Nepal, one of my best friends. I love that man. This Kukri weighs about 11 ounces.
God, that is gorgeous.
It is extremely, extremely fast. The edge geometry is superb, and it's razor, razor sharp. This is probably one of my fastest blades in the hand. I can maneuver this so fast, like it's just a blur. But when I started doing all the cut tests and the draws and everything, one of the men over there, we got to talk to him, message him back and forth, and I had a lot of respect for him. And he said something about me and maybe that I had been in a previous life. That's up, you know, and they believe in that. There's a lot of Hindu religion over there and different. But, of course, Bob, I was honored that he said that.
Sure.
Of course, I have a different belief in that, being a Christian. But I was honored that he thought that about me and the Kukri, because he could see how I could do with this blade. And I would always tell him, I said, I don't know what it is. I said, this blade is just an extension of me, and it's just innate in me. I couldn't explain, Bob. It's like this blade's always just been with me. It's like I'm most comfortable with this. It's like natural. It's something that's a part of me, and I can't explain it. I can't. But this is my favorite style blade.
So you're talking about the Kukri in general,
yes.
Not necessarily that specific one in your hand.
Right, the Kukri in general.
Okay.
Now there are different sizes and weights of the Kukri.
This one you just put away is so nice and slender.
Yes.
I love the look of that. It's looks like that's going to be a really nice one. Let's see that. Oh my
god. This is probably one of the most beautiful Kukris I have. This is the Papa Kukri. And this one, if you can see the width of the blade and the fullers in that blade, and if you can see the handle.
So it's got that the brass fittings, the beautiful, is that buffalo, a water buffalo horn?
It is, buffalo horn. So this blade is a lot wider and it's heavier than the previous blade. But the edge geometry on this blade, Bob, is such that I took a Clorox bottle, the big Clorox bottle, like the gallon jug, and I rinsed it out real well because I didn't want to damage my blade. And I filled it up completely with water. And I just held it up. And I had already had the Kukri in hand. And I just dropped the container and I sliced it. And I showed the container in the picture of that post I made. And it looked like, no joke, that a circular saw had made the cut. A fine circular saw. It was that clean. It was amazing. So that's due to the edge geometry and the sharpness of that blade.
So Kukri, how many Kukris do you have, would you say, in your collection?
I'll probably have, let me just think about that, maybe 30.
All right. So 30, okay, Kukri is definitely your thing. And we were talking about the Kopis that's over your left shoulder. That's kind of that's like a proto Kukri. So we know that that's your, what else? What else is out there in the world that's fetching? Is that a Krabi Krabong sword behind you?
This is a quarter sword. This was made by Perna. And this is an amazing.
Oh, I've seen this on Forged in Fire. That is really cool.
Yes.
It's like a sword axe.
Yes. So all the inside is sharpened.
As
you
can
see the detail on that. And then, of course, the pommel. But this sword is extremely light in the hand. It's amazing. So on this blade, like I said, inside is sharpened. But if that point catches, it comes in and draws everything into it. That point is razor sharp. So that's the quarter sword. So this sword is popular in Nepal and in India. But Perna forged that, and it's one of my prize blades. I'll never sell that one. That's just a prize blade to me.
So how did you start making content for social media, for YouTube and Instagram? Like, what was it that drove you to that?
Well, you know, I'd seen other people start doing the videos and everything, Bob. And then I think somebody at the fire department, actually, one of my firefighters might have said something to me about, you know, maybe I should start doing the videos and doing that. And so I mainly do Facebook and Instagram. And every once in a while, I'll post to YouTube. Now, there was a man in Las Vegas, a good friend of mine, who has a huge collection of blades. He's an older gentleman. And he was going to sponsor me on YouTube and everything. But I'll tell you how I am, Bob. I deal with how I feel, if that makes any sense. I know that there are bladesmiths who do take a lot of time because they have to have the right mindset and feeling when they start forging a blade. They may start forging it out. They may take a week off and then go back to it until they get the right frame of mind and have the right feeling toward it. That's my way of doing the videos is I don't want to be like under the gun, so to say, like that it's a burden to have to do videos. I love to do them, but I have to do them go by my feeling, I guess is what I'm trying to say, and express myself in that way. But yeah, that's how I got started. I saw other people doing it, and then somebody at the fire department, I believe, said, "Save y'all start doing that." And it was just a natural thing. I was seeing other people do it, and I just started out doing test cut videos of different blades. There's really simple tests. And then it went from that to I decided, well, let me see if I can draw a blade. And let me see if I can draw it fast. And then let me see if I can draw it fast enough to cut a container that I just drop out of my hand. And that's how it progressed. Just that simple.
So how has watching yourself do those cut tests improved your skills with the sword?
Oh, it does a lot because it's trial and error. Timing is everything on those cut tests. And you have to be fast, but you also have to be careful because there's a fine line when you're dealing with a live blade, a very fine line. I have found that out the hard way before. But you're not going to progress in anything if you stay scared or if you let something discourage you. And I've had a lot of people encourage me from the blade community. Because I don't know if you knew this, Bob. I had an accident back in February of last year. So I had a very, very sharp blade. It was a big Kardashian, Japanese style, razor sharp. The blade itself was about a little over 5 inches with a tip that I would say is probably my most, it'll penetrate any clothing, anything like it's not even there. It's the best penetrator I have, the best thrusting weapon I have. And I was doing a quick draw from underneath my
shoulder. Oh, yeah.
Yes. I wasn't doing a video, thank God, at the time. But I had it in a sheath underneath my shirt. To draw it with my right hand. I was going to pick up the shirt with my left hand. I've done this numerous times. And my philosophy, why I was doing that is, I felt like no matter where you are, y'all be able to draw fast, just out of the blue.
Yeah.
For real world application. So I didn't pull the shirt up high enough. The butt of the blade caught my shirt, rebounded in at a transverse angle into my abdomen,
and
through my stomach. So at the time, I didn't know. I went and grabbed a washcloth, was holding pressure. I needed to do that. And I was just hoping that it was just stuck in the muscle, didn't penetrate any further. But by the time I got to the emergency room and they put me back to the CAT scan, fortunate for me, I had probably the number one trauma doctor that was on call that night. And he came back and said, "Steve, I got bad news. You're bleeding internally."
Oh, my God.
So he had to do emergency surgery. He had to go in, scope me three different places, sew me up from the inside and from the outside. And after that, you know, yeah, that's a traumatic experience. I'll say, you know, it is traumatic, but I have had a lot of people that I highly respect message me, call me, and encourage me because they knew it was going to be an overcoming to get back to doing what I was doing. And I appreciate everybody that called me, messaged me, made a post on the Facebook page. When I made a post about that, I want everybody to know how precious you are to me. That meant the world to me. And it was just one of those things, you know. And I would advise anybody that's practicing to use a training blade from cover. Use a training blade because it can happen to anybody. But yeah, that's an experience.
Yeah, I mean, that you're really underlining that it can happen to anybody because you're obviously skilled and you do a lot of that. You've done a lot of that quick draw stuff that we've seen. And yeah, but from under the shirt, catching on the shirt and pushing it right in. I mean, I could totally visualize that and man, that's awful. But like you said, anyone can make a mistake like that. And I have not as high stakes as yours, because I wasn't doing anything as high stakes as you, but that's a learning experience for sure. And not that you didn't have ultimate respect for the blade, but that'll give you even more of it.
Absolutely.
I bet.
Yeah.
So on the job, over the years as a fireman and as a policeman, did you see the damage that knives can do to people from fights and stuff like that? Was that something you were around at all?
Mostly gunshots, but I'll say this because I'm no longer a police officer, so I can talk about it. But when I was a rookie police officer here in Huntsville, I saw what an axe can do to a person. And I'm trying to think if it was an axe or a machete. Either way, at that time, I can't recall if it was an axe or a machete. It might have been a machete. It was at a hotel here in Huntsville. And we get there, and the guy had been hit in the head with it. And needless to say, the head is no match for a machete. It was very bad, Bob. Mainly what I've been involved with is gunshots. They're more prevalent here in Huntsville than knives are, although there are people that get stabbed, you know, quite often, but mainly we don't hear about those a lot. Mainly it's gunshots.
Just incidentally, I'm going to be shooting a video soon with the fire department around here about stopping bleeding, you know, excessive bleeding from things like gunshots and stabbings or whatever. You know, you could be out swimming and you cut yourself on a piece of metal, whatever it is. How important is it for us knife dudes and dudettes to learn medical stuff, first aid stuff, like real legit first aid?
Oh, it is absolutely important. I mean, the first thing I did when I had my accident, right away, about the split second, was grab a washcloth and do compression on my abdomen. You can't put a tourniquet on an abdomen.
So yeah.
There are places on your body that a tourniquet's not going to help. But I would be very familiar with tourniquet application, compression, and everything like that, and just wound mitigation. So if you're around blades at all, you definitely need that knowledge, because you can cut a place in your arm, you can hit an artery. I remember a man that I followed for a while on YouTube was very, very proficient with a katana. And I'm the extreme proficient. But he had one that was a little longer that he had just gotten. And mainly, you know, they're around 28, 29 inch blade length. This, I think, might have been over 30. And he did a draw, and he hit the upper part of his arm right here when he drew it. And I don't know if he just nicked the artery or whatever, but he didn't hit it all the way through. But it just put him down for a while, hitting that place in the break. So you got to break your artery that runs right through there. And he might have nicked it or whatever, but I know it scared him because he was off for a little while off the channel. But then he came back and talked about it, and he learned from that experience of what blade length he could draw that technique proficiently with. He'd been doing the draw with the 28, 29 inch blades all along. And when he had that longer blade and coming up, it did not make it out of that area without cutting. So, yes, learning how to mitigate that is essential for anybody dealing with a blade. I highly recommend it.
I find myself sometimes absentmindedly playing with or handling whatever knife happens to be on me or in my pocket. And I'm okay with that if I'm stationary, say if I'm sitting at my desk, and I'm just absentmindedly playing with a knife. Worst I can do is probably cut my hand or something, but, I'll find myself walking around doing that, and I have to stop myself, put it back, because that's how I've done dumb stuff. And I'm not calling, not every knife mistake is a dumb mistake, but I've made some really stupid ones.
Yeah.
And, I've been lucky, that I haven't, hit the wrong spot. Actually, some of the worst accidents I've ever had was when I worked in professional kitchens, you know, just as a prep guy, but still those big knives and just, coming in early in the morning and prepping all sorts of food and doing it absentmindedly. So yeah, mindfulness is a pretty important thing, especially around blades. How much of what you do, especially with these, with the cutting and with the drawing and cutting, how quickly you do it, how much of that is a mind game?
Yeah, it starts with the mind, Bob. Your focus has to be there. There has to be focus. I've done a couple of blindfold cut tests where I blindfold myself and do the draw and cut. And you have to have spatial awareness, body awareness, and you have to be dialed in the zone. Nothing else can be on your mind. Nothing exterior. You can't be thinking about something, anything else has to be cleared out of your mind. We Americans, we call it being zoned in. And that mitigated a lot of the problems. You have to have respect for the blade because you know what I use are live blades. And what people can make a mistake by watching certain individuals that are just drawing blades really fast, especially in the katana arena. And a lot of those katanas are not shinkens. They're not sharpened swords. And those people can get away with that. They can draw extremely fast, resheath it extremely fast, back and forth. And don't get me wrong, that's a good way to familiarize yourself, practice it. And then when you get to a live blade, you've got the fundamentals and the foundation built. But it's totally different when you put a live blade in your hand. If you've only been doing non-sharpened blades all your life for many years, and then you put a live blade in there, it's a different mindset, totally different mindset. I believe you have to have both. I believe you need to train with an unsharpened blade and train with a live blade. Even though I started with live blades, that one time it did cost me. But I would be better off on certain areas if I would get me some training blades and practice and get some more fundamentals down to sharpen my skills even more. I don't want people to make that mistake of watching somebody who does something extremely fast and going down that road. It takes time and effort and concentration and knowing your own abilities. You have to know yourself above all other. You know, you have to know what you're capable of and what your limitations are. I know what my limitations are, and I try to stay right there at that limit, not go over it.
Oh, well, what to you are the modern applications of such a skill? You mentioned in your time as a police officer and a firefighter in Huntsville, you saw mostly gunshot wounds. Is there any modern application to knowing the sword?
That's a good question. And I know a lot of people have thoughts on this and opinions on this. I'm trying to make sure I say this in the right way, not offend anybody, because I love the sword, and a lot of my friends love the sword. But I feel like unless somebody, you know, if somebody does a home invasion on you, you're probably going to pull a fire on them. You're not going to go to your sword. Unless, Bob, and I hate to use this terminology, some people say zombie apocalypse. But let's just say, I'm not going to say zombie apocalypse. I'm going to say, let's just say something happens to where something bad happens in this world. And we're down to where you're having to survive of what you can get your hands on, feed yourself off of killing live game, that sort of stuff. And then ammo eventually down the road, because it's going to be way down the road, because America has a lot of ammo and a lot of guns. But down the road, ammo runs out. Then I can see where a blade such as a sword would come in handy as far as self-defense. A blade's going to come in handy anyway in that scenario as far as processing game, chopping vegetables, chopping down trees to build you a fire, you know, anything like that. A blade's going to come in handy, don't get me wrong. But as far as self-defense goes, that's the only thing I think it would be handy for at that time. You're not going to carry around a sword underneath your garment, or you're not going to wear it. Even though Texas, I hear, you can wear a sword in Texas. you're not going to, because how the public sees, you know. I do wear pretty large blades out in public sometimes. I've worn this quite often.
Wow, that's cool.
I wear this from Kiku Matsuda.
Ooh,
Master Smith out of Japan.
Hey, well, Steve, how much of the sword skill translates into knife skill or empty hand skill?
Oh, it does. So, the sword skill, when we get into that, we're talking about different ranges. So, anybody that's familiar with, there's a lot of people that are familiar with the sword. You got your HEMA people who are extremely familiar with it, and I have respect for those people because they practice that art all the time. And then your Kenjutsu practitioners, I have high respect for those men and women that do that. But we're talking about range. So a sword is built for a certain range. But the way you can maneuver it and your awareness of the blade, how it cuts, some of that will transfer to a shorter blade. But not all of it, because this is a closer range application. And your maneuvers of how you would maneuver a blade. So if you come down an angle strike, right? You're with one hand. You're of the long sword. You're not going to do that. European long sword, you're going to use two hands, and you may make a one cut at an angle. But this, as far as I'm talking about maneuvering it fast. So if you get to the Filipino FMA martial arts, Bob, you know what I'm talking about. So you come in straight, come in at different angles, right? Different angles, applications. There's a different set of applications for a short blade in the closer range. There's a different application for a karambit, which I should have had up here, because that's my short range favorite weapon. And I have some from Indonesia that are extremely, extremely well built, extremely sharp. So those require different techniques at close range. And there's been people that have built different blades for extreme close range, for grappling range. And I think you've went over some of those men that teach those combatives and develop the, I can't remember the name of it, but it's a really, it's got like a ball grip, and the blade is curved in.
You talk about the shiv works, or you're talking
shiv
about
work. Yes, the shiv yeah. work. So, and so that man, he knows his stuff.
Yeah.
I have followed him some. He's done the work, he's been undercover. He knows what it takes when you get into those scenarios. In a tight scenario, whether you're sitting in a car as an undercover agent and the person you're buying from, they have questions and they start asking you and they get the wrong feeling towards you and then they attack because they think you're a cop. Well, he's been in those situations. He knows close range, grappling range, what's going to work, what you can draw, how you can draw it, how long the blade needs to be, because you may not have room to draw a long blade.
Yeah.
Then when you're close in grappling with somebody, someone around them, and I don't mean to get gross or anything, but I'm saying if you have to come around the back of the neck, back, yep. anywhere back, so you're around them and you're directly access your blade. You know what I'm saying, Bob? That blade comes in handy because of the way it's designed and configured for that application. So there's different range. A sword, some of it's transferable to shorter blades, but not all of it.
In the Filipino martial arts, at least as I've been exposed to them, where the swords themselves, except for, you know, with a few exceptions, the swords themselves are about 29 inches or so, as the practice sticks are. So about the length of the blade of an average katana. So it's a shorter range weapon, and it all, there's that, the Beigler, Genuntik. That short range weapon translates into a knife, translates into empty hand pretty flawlessly. But when you start getting longer and the ranges get bigger, it changes. Let's hold that up. I hefted one of these at Blade Show and really fell in love with it. Beautiful modern Genunting by Beigler Bladeworks.
Yeah, it's a Beigler.
Beigler. Okay.
Brian Beigler Bladeworks. Yeah, it's a remarkable blade. And I'll say this about this. I told you, like, that Kardashi that was made by Jeremy Boulder Valentine, by the way, highly recommend him. He's an American blade maker, and I highly recommend Jeremy. He makes some incredible blades. But this would be my second one as far as thrusting ability. The tip on this, when I say it's amazing, it's amazing. It doesn't matter how many layers of clothing you put on. It's going to go through. I have tested this. And what's different about this tip to me is, and I'm sure you're familiar with some of this, Bob, is this tip, it's hard to explain. It comes to a rounded, extremely sharp tip. So where some blades, the geometry is more like a triangular point, and those come to a
sharp. Oh, okay.
This is a point. It is a round. When I say rounded, it's extremely sharp point, but it's a rounded sort of tip geometry, and so it thrusts through everything. It's incredible.
That I know what you're saying. It kind of comes to like, if you will, a pencil tip.
Yes.
That seems great. And there are, I can't name them, but there are a lot of examples where I've seen thrusting knives throughout history that have tips like that. And then the blade changes after the tip. Yeah, this is gorgeous. You got about 6 inches of the top edge sharp.
Yes.
Man, that is a definitely an enviable blade. So with all this and with, having the medical training, I'm just talking about the average person because I want to get your advice on this. So we've talked about, knives, self-defense, and medical training to make sure that, if your knife hobby gets out of hand for an instant, you can take care of yourself. But what about exercise? What about, staying in shape? You obviously are in great shape. I've seen on Instagram you, deadlifting 450 pounds 10 times in a row, or what have you. Obviously fitness means something to you. What advice do you give people about the importance of that, especially when it comes to self-defense, especially when it comes to survival or enjoying the hobby of swordplay?
So there's a lot of aspects to, I'll say this about martial arts and blade works in the martial arts. You have some people who are, they look from the outside. Bob, you can't always judge a book by its cover. For instance, they look like they might be out of shape, but they're in better shape than you think they are. And they are highly skilled with the blade. I've seen some of those individuals, but I will say this. Even if you're highly skilled, if you run up against somebody who is also highly skilled, but is extremely fit, that's where you're going to run into trouble. So if you have an untrained person and a highly, highly skilled person who's in all right shape, all right, this person is going to win out, the highly skilled person. But if you have a person equal skill level, but is in a lot better shape than you, you're going to lose. Because fatigue makes cowards of us all. And strength is going to come into it, because if you have a man who is highly skilled, and let's say you're highly skilled yourself, and you can block some of his maneuvers or whatever, when he gets into grappling range and gets a hold of you, it's a different ballgame. And a person that's out of shape, let's say it comes to hands, right? The person they may have a minute, 2 minutes at the most in them. And there's a lot of people out there that think they can fight wild, and they might can go hard a minute or two.
Yeah.
But if there's a person that knows what they're doing, you're going to have to last a lot longer than that. And that's where fitness and strength come into play. Even being able to maneuver a blade, this Ganutti is very light. But your power and speed and your force equal mass times acceleration, right? So when you can maneuver a blade extremely fast from the power that you can generate, that cutting ability is exponentially advanced up. So and that even working out with a blade, right? If you work out with a blade for a period of time, you can see how maneuvering with a blade and your footwork and doing everything, you got to be in shape to do that. You look at a lot of the HEMA competitions, and those guys that are like really upper level, they are in great shape. So yeah, fitness comes into it, because you have to have the cardiovascular along with the strength. And that's why when I was 44, like I said, I'm 57 now, but when I was 44, I started doing CrossFit. And there's a lot of opinions about CrossFit and everything else. But I've been in global gyms all my life and grew up doing martial arts and everything. But as far as functional fitness, having the cardio, the VO2 max, the strength, being able to move your body with explosive power, I've not found anything like that. And I started when I was 4, so I've been doing it for 13 years.
Fifth.
And it kept me in great shape as a firefighter. I wish I had it back when I was a police officer, but they didn't have it back then. But yeah, fitness is key. It is. Training is key. Fitness is key. Having the right instructor is key. There's a lot of keys to that journey.
Well, one last question before I let you go, and it's about the journey, if you will, and it's about the collecting. What recommendation, what advice do you give someone who's new, who wants to have a collection like yours? They want to have exotic weapons from actual makers from around the world. How do you start?
I don't mind anybody that wants to contact me, Bob, because they may not know the makers to contact. And I'll say this. I want to support our American blade makers. They've been good to me. For instance,
this is
the Wakizashi from Forged and Fire champion James Hill.
Yeah, that is gorgeous.
And I bought this at Blade Show year before last. I've done demos with this. It's an exceptional blade. Exceptional blade. And Americans, because of our economy, Bob, and the high cost of living, people need to understand, American bladesmiths, and I'm not talking about like cold steel, right? I'm not talking about the Raja, which you can get for $70 or $80 or whatever, which I love this blade. But it, you know, that's coming from a big company that processes a lot of blades, that manufactures a lot of blades. To get a custom blade is it's pretty expensive here in America. You can get a high quality blade overseas, delivered to you in a very short time, made by some men of great integrity, forging blades like their ancestors did. Anybody I would recommend starting out with those blades because they're not too expensive. They're not expensive at all. And then when you get into the hobby and you want to go with like Brian's blade or James blade or a blade from Kiku Matsuda, or let me see here. Oh, and so I'm going to show this blade real quick. So this blade,
I know what this is.
A lot of people love this blade.
So cool.
So the Raja Wali. That's from Shani and Ralph Pinata out of Indonesia. That blade is incredible itself. So you can get a blade like this for a reasonable price. And then you've got blade makers like Christopher Linton, who I'm good friends with, and he started working for RMJ Tactical. He's a custom blade maker. But this is the Samurai Buoy that he forged out.
That is something else with that subhilt. I love that.
Yes. It is an incredible, incredible blade. I've done tatami cuts with this back when I was getting some tatami mats in, and it's an incredible blade. That's a Samurai Buoy knife. And so start out with something relatively inexpensive, but it's high quality. And then you can work your way up to some of the custom makers. You know, a lot of this I got at Blade Show starting out. I've been, I think, 4 or 5 years. And you get to see some. I highly recommend everybody go to Blade Show. The community is incredible. Everybody is very humble. Even the bladesmiths are very humble. There are bladesmiths there with $2,000-$4,000 blades on their table. And a person may walk up, and the blade maker themselves may know, Bob, that this person probably is not going to buy their blade.
Oh, yeah.
How expensive it is. But they will talk to that person just as if they were talking to somebody who was a millionaire who walked up, who was absolutely going to buy that blade. That's what I love about the blade community. It's a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And everybody at Blade Show is so humble, so nice and kind. And it's the best community. It is the best community.
I couldn't agree more with you, Steve. Great words to end on. It is a great community, and it's people like you, people like me, people like all of us getting together, talking about these things, and also sharing our love. Some people love small EDCs. Some people love slip joints, some fixed blades, some swords, but we kind of all come together around the sharpened heat-treated steel. Steve Price, Bladetastic Knives, thank you so much for coming on the Knife Junkie podcast. It's been a pleasure to have this time talking with you.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's been an honor and a privilege. Love your show. You are the best. I mean, you do the best job. You have some incredible people on your show. And you do so much for the Blade community. And we value you. I want you to know that. The community values you. You are exceptional at what you do. And I hope to see you at Blade Show this year.
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, thank you for those kind words. Put wind in my sails, sir. All right, sir. You take care.
You too.
Knife-themed shirts, hoodies, mugs, water bottles, and more. TheKnifeJunkie.com/shop.
Do you carry multiple knives? Then overthink which one to use when an actual cutting chore pops up? You're a knife junkie of the first order.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. Steve Price of Bladetastic Knives. That's his Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube handle. And his advice, a lot like mine, it seems like, when I talk about getting into custom fixed blades, starting small and starting with people whose work you like. Maybe you're scrolling on Instagram. That's how I find them. And then starting small and building up. And you could have an amazing collection of custom swords yourself. All right. Be sure to join us on Wednesday for the midweek supplemental, Thursday for Thursday Night Knives at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. And we'll see you there. All right. For Jim working his magic behind the switcher, I'm Bob DeMarco saying until next time, don't take dull for an answer.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487 and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.